Reading from the Sri Bhakti Sandarbha, Anuchade 238. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. An example of service by association is spoken of by Krishna. Neither yoga nor analytical study of conceptual truth, nor carrying out one's moral obligations, nor study of the Vedas, nor austerity renunciation or distribution of food and works of public welfare, nor charity, fast, worship of deities and sacrifice, reciting mantras, visiting holy places, nor observing rules and regulations can captivate me, as does the association of saints, which removes all other attachments. Amigana Kimarandasya Jananjana Silakaya Taksurun Vitamyena is my Sri Gurave Maha Dukhe Tanya Mano Vishtam Api Tanya Na Bhutale Sayam Rupa Kadamayam Adati Tapadhantikam Adadanas Charangante Idam Yache Puna Puna Shima Rupa Padam Bhoja Ulisham Janma Jambani Vairagya Yudhakti Risham Piyatnai Apayana Manadipsamandham Tipam Budhiya Paradhuka Dhuki Sanatanastam Prabhumasriyami Vansha Kalpa Tarubhyasya. Someone just got on and is playing with the phone. Adhidhanas tanandante idam yache puna puna shimadhuta padam bhoja yulisham janma jandani tanagiri bhakti risham piyatnai apayama maradipsamandam kutam buhiya paradhuka dhuki janathanasam prabhumastriyami ansha kalpa tarubhyascha Kripa Sindhu Bhayevacha Patitanam Padmejo Vaishnavejo Namo Namah Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhunithananda Vyadvaita Gadadha Shivakade Gaur Bhaktavinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Namo, Hare Namo, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So, greetings from the Saint Paul's, where I finally have a suitable residence, and I'm enjoying so much staying up here, a simple monk's life. Studying Shastra and writing. So we're on this wonderful book, Bhakti Sandarbha, which explains the Abhideya Tattva of the Gaudiya Vaishnava conclusions, that the means, the Abhideya, the means of realizing the absolute reality is bhakti. And it's a complete analysis of how bhakti is the Abhideya on the basis of the Srimad Bhagavatam. And now it's explaining the various practices of devotional service, beginning with Sharanagati. Sharanagati is actually the symptoms of faith. Faith in the Supreme Lord as the ultimate shelter. It's actually faith in our relationship with Krishna, that our relationship with God, our relationship with Krishna is the ultimate shelter. It is the ultimate place where our heart can be fully satisfied, and it is the place which has the power to actually protect the our relationship with Krishna. Bhaktivinoda Thakur says that every object has a vastu, every object or substance, every vastu or thing has a corresponding function, which is called dharma. And the function of the vastu or substance called the living entity is to serve Krishna. And that is the shelter. And the symptoms of one who has complete faith in God and his relationship with God as that shelter is that he does everything favorable, everything to please Krishna, and everything favorable to take shelter of Krishna. He avoids everything that's unfavorable. He has firm conviction that in that relationship, I am protected. What is protected? My dharma, my love of Krishna is protected by Krishna, who is my guardian. He's nourishing. And one is very satisfied with that position of servant. And in his heart, he gives up all independence. He surrenders to the desire and will of the Supreme Lord. So that was discussed, and then it made a very interesting point, how powerful that Sharanagata is. It's the entrance to bhakti, that type of faith. And if one wants a flavor of a particular mood of devotion, one has to take shelter of a spiritual master. So many verses were given on how important that is, the spiritual, serving the spiritual master, so many verses were given on that. And then it came to the point of satsanga. What about the service of the saints in general? And it's recommended that one shouldn't be narrow-minded, that one should certainly serve other Vaishnavas, providing it doesn't conflict or is in harmony with one's spiritual master. And then Mahamuni asked a very interesting question. Can the guru restrict one from even serving an advanced devotee even if it's in the same family or the same life, if he sees that his teachings are different than his own and his own spiritual master? And the answer is, if one is a bona fide spiritual master and not envious, if he does see a conflict, then we accept that there is one. If we have that faith, what does it say? It says, that wasn't as clear as I wanted, let me just do that again. It says, with the permission of Guru, one can lend a sangha provided it doesn't conflict with the service of one's guru. So if one does see that there is conflict, and he is not envious, and he's a bona fide spiritual master, then yes, it is possible that there is some conflict. And it's also possible that the person is envious, but that one has to decide within his heart. If one has faith in a spiritual master and sees that he's not envious, and his interest, and he's guiding you, and you have faith in that guidance and his interest in your life, then yes, if he makes some distinction and says that this is different, that doesn't mean that he's envious. It means that he's used his discrimination. Then it mentioned very interesting. I'm getting pretty quickly. We're up to today, and then it says, well, "What happens if the guru leaves?" Then the conclusion is that one should accept another advanced Vaishnav who belongs to one's own community. It means it belongs to your own sampradaya for the progress of you. That this is for your benefit. And you should make sure that you accept the great devotee who's compassionate towards oneself. Because if he's not compassionate, then the heart will not develop affection. Because the affection happens within relationship. So if he's not affectionate, which means he doesn't have a relationship with you, and the relationship is not, if he doesn't have a relationship with you, then the affection won't develop. That's natural. Affection develops in relationship. And that affection is essential in our spiritual advancement because it's a bhakti movement. And the affection develops actually first in relationships to devotees. And then that sense of love and devotion, from that we can have some idea of our affection and love for Krishna. And therefore, it says, the recommendation is this: one should serve devotees. And then, I went pretty fast today because we discussed this many times. So now it discusses that there are actually two types of service to the great devotees. One is called prasanga, it says in the form of association, and one is called parichaya. And that means basically service. And it's basically, as far as I understand, prasanga means hearing from devotees, and parichaya means you render physical services. So now he's going to discuss these types of satsanga and how significant the satsanga is. And he begins with a verse. By the way, those of you who want to follow this, what Jiva Goswami is going to do now is analyze the 11th canto of Bhagavatam, the 12th chapter. Those are the verses he's going to explain. He's going to explain about 7 or 8 verses. And fortunately enough, a lot of the commentary that I'm going to study and read is translated within the purports of the Bhagavatam. There's a lot of the purports in those verses are translations of Jiva Goswami's commentary. So it starts off with this verse on chapter 12, text 1, where it describes Nidhi Yoga. None of these things are as powerful they're not as powerful. You can't captivate. You want the Lord's heart. You won't please him as much as if you serve a devotee. And he said, nothing will captivate me as does this type of association, the satsanga, serving a devotee. And he names, many, many different things. Nidhi Yoga, Sankhya. Actually, I have my Bhagavatam here. I'm going to even go to the verse. And it's going to be a very, very amazing analysis of this satsanga. It's very interesting. It goes up to the highest service. The highest service of the devotees, which is the service of the gopis. And it's very, very interesting in this section. So it says, does not control me what? Sankhya, Dharma, Swadhyaya study, Tapasya, Tyagya, Purtam, Ishtapurtam, sacrifices, Lakshin charity, Vrata, fast such as Ekadasi, Yajna, all these things, Kirtani, going to holy places, Niyam, the rules, the regulation, nothing as satsanga, satsango paho imam, certainly nothing brings me avarande, brings me under control. Nothing brings me as good as this satsanga. And this is going to be analyzed. Now, as I remember, one thing that's very nice, and I think probably the group that it comes on Wednesday, I've actually designed that class, that it's quite a philosophical class. But Jiva Goswami, he knows, I'm going to make a joke, that Gail is in the audience. He knows that there's critical minds that want contradictions resolved. And he knows that in the previous chapter, a verse was stated that appears to contradict this one, because this verse says nothing. Not going to please me as much as the satsanga. But the verse in the previous chapter, which described all types of devotional service, said, this is 11.11.47, and the last verse in this chapter is, the last verse in the last chapter is, let me just get that, was 49. So just, you know, Jiva Goswami, you know, it's the Bhagavatam. So, you know, Jiva Goswami knows that if he's giving commentary on the Bhagavatam, just three verses before, it states, one who worships me is described above with fixity of mind through Vedic sacrifices and acts of social welfare, attain true devotion to me through service to saintly devotees. Constant remembrance of me is born. So here it says in this verse, before it says, not this, not this, not this, nothing can do it as much as the association of devotees. In this verse, it appears to say that this firmness of bhakti, which takes place by service saintly, is reliant on other needs. And it mentions the exact same things. It mentions the exact same things that were in this verse that come, that the first verse we read, which was actually after this one, which says, not by fast, not by this, not by this, not by this, not by this, as Sada Sangha. But here it says that by doing these things, you can attain the true devotion. Almost as if the true devotion and the Sada Sangha is reliant on these other things. The Jiva Goswami, the way he resolved this, and it's very easy. So he analyzes that these words, they're actually used in different ways. And it's very, very clear for the text. For example, when it says, not by sacrifices, which is the word ishta, and not by purta, which means building the temples and creating gardens and digging wells. Those refer to, without the text, I'm going to have to be very, very clear. So let's say in the 12th chapter, at the beginning, it mentions not these things, but sadhusanga. Then in the end of the 11th chapter, just a few verses before, it says, that these things lead to intense devotion, as if devotion is reliant on them. So in the 11th chapter, what Jiva Goswami shows by going to the verses, that in the 11th chapter, those verses are referred to sacrifices and activities that are specifically meant for worshiping the Lord. And in this verse, and in the verse in the 12th chapter, it says, not this, not this, with the same words are used, sacrifice, etc. It refers to sacrifices that are not performed specifically for the pleasure of the Lord. And therefore, they cannot captivate it. Because it's the same, some of the same words are used. And then he goes back, okay, let's go back to the 11th chapter, where these words are used in a way that specifically relate to the Supreme Lord. So he shows what verses are discussed. For example, when it mentions sacrifice in the 11th canto, it gives the verse. In 43 it says, one should worship me by performing ghee in the sacrificial fire. So that type of sacrifice that can help you attain true devotion and lead you to service to the saintly devotees, that's the type of sacrifice that is worship of Krishna, which we do in the temple sometimes. We do the Agnihotra. Similarly, the word purta in the verse, which purta means social welfare activity, in the 38th verse, in the 38th verse, it says, create a flower garden, a fruit orchard, a pleasure grove, or town or temple for me. Actually, it's even part of the first class deity worship is when you not only offer in a pure way, the fruit and the flower to Krishna. But the deity worship starts when you put the seed in the ground and you grow your own flowers. So those of you, one of the favorite places and pilgrimages that we go to is the in Samanta Dweep in Mayapur, where they have that Jagannath Mandir. And the opulence is indescribable because they have about 40 or 50 acres, and after we see the Jagannath deities, which actually came from Puri, it's Lord Jagannath in Mayapur, and that's Jagannath Puri in Mayapur. And you go after taking the Chapan Bhog, where they cook 56 preparations, and we sit down and eat this wonderful puri type prasad. And we go around the back and we walk through these forests and fields, the house of Kodavacha Sridhar. It's amazing. It's just beautiful out in these fields. You can't imagine a more pristine environment. And when you go along there, you see that everything the deity needs is in that garden. You see there's mango trees, and there's flowers, and vegetable gardens, and cotton fields. And so this type of social welfare activity, when you create a flower garden, a fruit orchard, a pleasure grove of flowers, it is developed. And that's what was being referred to when it described how these things can lead to intense devotion. Very nice. It says, very nice. If one should faithfully and lovingly support the installation of my deity, and individually or in cooperation with others should work for the construction of Krishna conscious temples and cities, as well as flower gardens, fruit gardens, and special areas to celebrate my pastimes. Um, So, you know, this type of stuff that with Prabhupada wanted in New Vrindavan, Varsana Maharaj is living next door. Again, so nice to see him in much better health and wonderful association, but, you know, he created New Vrindavan, the ponds, the things. One should consider oneself to be my humble servant without duplicity, and thus should help to clean the temple, which is my home. First one should sweep and dust thoroughly, and then one should further cleanse with water and cow dung. Having dried the temple, one should sprinkle scented water and decorate the temple with mandalas. One should act just like myself. So this is what it's talking about. So it says, Jiva Goswami says, one who worships me in this way, through this type of sacrifice and welfare activity or described, obtains remembrance of me. And by service through the sadhus, the associate, one attains. This is the import of this verse. In this instance, because one offers oblations in the fire, which is understood to be the seat of the Lord, and is feature of the supreme indwelling soul. In the Rag section, it's very interesting. It says, someone in Rag Marg never sees Krishna in the fire. He always sees Paramatma in the fire. Why? Because it was Krishna. Because in Rag Marg, you see Krishna as human, not as God. He said, well, in Rag Marg, didn't see Krishna fire because he Krishna would be burning to death. Mother Yasoda, she sees Krishna. She said, see Krishna in the fire, my God. Look at when she saw Krishna in the coils of the Kaliya serpent. Similarly, so such activities included in bhakti. Similarly, welfare activities such as digging wells and making gardens can also be included in bhakti when I'm taken for the service of the Lord. Thus, the association of saints would generate firmness in devotion is said to be assisted by any means. So, those words, when used in the end of the 11th chapter, which is this whole description of devotional service, refer to sacrifices and social welfare activities. And those could be. And the other verse, it's not necessarily referring to those. It refers to it's going to be described. Well, an interesting thing, yet in the same chapter, that 11th chapter, it is said that in comparison to other methods, association of saints is capable of wanting the desired result independently. So what happens is, even though it describes that intense devotion can come from these activities, you don't require those activities to get intense devotion and the association of sadhus. The service of the devotee is capable of awarding it independently, and it has supreme power. It wants to emphasize the supreme power of associating with saints. And therefore, at the end of the chapter, Krishna describes this service to the saints at the end of this 11th chapter as supremely confidential. And therefore he says, therefore, O descendant of Yadu, Uddhava, this part of the Uddhava Gita, just hear this Paramaguryam, this topmost secret. Although it is supremely confidential, I will disclose it to you because you are my servant, well-wisher, and friend. So the topmost secret is what? That is nothing that is the power of associating with saints. And I was just reading in this book, Encounters with Divinity. Oh, I wish it, now I'm taking notes, but it described that, you know, the sadhu is passive knowledge. The devotees are active knowledge. The Shastra doesn't go after you to correct you. The Shastra doesn't, you know, but the sadhus are active. And then it describes more active than the murti or the deity is the Shastra, and more active than the Shastra is the devotee. The devotee is active, it can move towards you. Even if you lack awareness of it. Of course, the Guru can also move. The Shastra can also move in ways. But that takes you on awareness to understand that. So what is that most confident? So now he wants to explain. No, the sadhu is different. It's not just relying. It can act independently. It's powerful. Then it starts. The answer when he explains that topmost secret, then that verse that we're discussing in the 12th chapter, neither by yoga nor samkhya, by Odyssey, by worship of deities, etc. Nothing can captivate me as the service of the saints. The service of the saints. If you can serve those who have given Krishna Sangha their heart to me, because within those saints, what is it, Govinda, Kohena, I am, what does Krishna say, that Garanga Prasarala Pachatitana, only by bathing in the Ganga many, many times can one become purified. But not even embracing, not even, simply by seeing the saint, one can become purified. But the Ganga, you have to go in and out many, many times, but simply by seeing the saint. That's by Narottam Das Thakur. And in the same verse, song he sings, that Govinda is in, what is it? I am in the heart of the devotees in my heart. I am in the heart of the devotees. Okay, so here it says, because no other process was said to have such power, the association of saints is described as supremely confidential. In the beginning of the next chapter, Krishna speaks the two verses quoted at the beginning, not by yoga, not. Let me read a little bit. We're going pretty well tonight. In these two verses, the word tyaga means sannyas, and not by sannyas. Dakshina refers to charity in general, yajna to the worship of gods, and chandamsi to recitation of secret mantras. According to sentence syntax, the verse states that yoga, the analytical study of conceptual truth and so on, cannot captivate the Lord in the same way as the association of saints. Very important in the next sentence. This statement implies that those other activities also captivate the Lord to some extent. In this respect, they understood it being directed towards the Lord and not in the usual sense. He's saying, even if you take these statements as directed towards the Lord, because they, as it said, it doesn't have to mean. It can mean you're performing sacrifice and social activities that are not performed specifically for the pleasure of the Lord. But you can also, by sentence syntax, also interpret it to mean that these activities captivate the Lord and direct it. But still, the implication is that they don't captivate the Lord as much as the service to the saints. I was reading in the fourth canto of the Bhagavatam. And if I stay up here, I think I'll be able to actually have these references here, because when it's traveling, I don't have my library. But there's a nice quote from Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, where he describes this Vishvangena Guru Deva, this infinite service to the spiritual master. And it gave this example, which you'd understand in the context when it was written 500 years ago, but it said, just as a chaste wife may even neglect the husband, or may even neglect the children for the service of the husband. In the same way, the devotee has that intimate sense of service to his guru and is performing that intimate service, even they sacrifice to some extent the bliss of chanting and hearing. Of course, before you think you can do that, you better really have Vishwam Deva Guru Seva, that intimate, confidential sense of service. So now, to emphasize this point, because there's a commentary by Sri Goswami that some of these words in this 12th chapter that are kind of rejected, not this, not this, are activities that can captivate the world to some extent. Sri Goswami in his commentary, because one of the things says, vetas. He says the word dhatani or vows refers to observing fasts connected with the word such as ekadasi. So he gives the reference. It does mean they are also directed to the words, and still they're not as good as sadhusanga. From this, one should not conclude, but here's another thing that Jiva Goswami does, and he brings it out in the commentaries, that people, they don't understand sometimes how to interpret the Shastra. And they take statements in the wrong way. And what to speak, if it was done 500 years ago and this book was written, what to speak of the folio scholarship today, when the whole basis of Shastra is sambandha jnan, understanding truths in relationship to other truths. People who tend to isolate truths make evil. I read that statement. I forgot when I read that all truth is relative truth being made absolute. Renunciation is a truth. You know, if you make it the only truth, then you start condemning everything that's attachment, even the things that are needed in Krishna's service. You know, distributing books is a truth. But if you don't study in relationship to other truths, then you begin to condemn even the practice of sadhana bhakti. You begin to condemn, beauty worship. You begin to condemn people, renunciation as a truth. You know, if it's not in relationship to other truths, you begin to condemn grihasthas, women, etc. It goes on and on. So Jiva Goswami, the one thing that I so much appreciate in studying is that he really shows what sambandha jnana is. So you have to understand truths in relationship to other truths. So he says, when it says, not by mantras, not by fast can you captivate me as much as sadhu sangha, he said, from this you should not conclude that regular devotional duties, such as the observance of Vaishnava fasting days, need not be followed. Because if one activity is singled out for its unique capacity to yield the desired result, it does not negate the regular observance of other duties. So he gives an example. He said, for example, in the path of karma, it is said, O King, the Lord who is the enjoyer of all sacrifices, is not as pleased by oblations into the fire as by food offered into the mouth of Brahmins. So this is even for the Bhagavatam, 7:14-17. So it says, the Lord is not pleased by oblations into the fire as offered. So he says, on the strength of this statement, one cannot forsake the injunction given in the previous verse. One should worship the Lord by the performance of sacrifice, such as Agnihotra. That was the verse before this one. It says he's not as pleased by this as by Brahmin, by feeding the Brahmins. But the previous verse said you should worship by Agnihotra. On the basis of one, you can't neglect the other. And evidently, at the time of Jiva, there were, he was dealing with people who are hearing these verses on the significance of sex songs, and giving up a codicil, and giving up sacrifice, and so many other things. This is what happens. He said, similarly, one cannot give up other duties because of the singular glorification of satsanga. By the same token, we find statements such as this, addressed to those on the path of devotion. The worship of my devotee exceeds the worship of me. Srimad Bhagavatam 11:19-21. But even on hearing such statements, one is not advised to give up the worship of the Lord, which is meant to be done regularly after taking initiation. The same logic here applies in regard to regular devotional activities, which are not preempted by the superiority of satsanga. Again, we cite verses like this from Skanda Purana. In Kali Yuga, one attains the same result simply by eating food offered to Lord Vishnu as one would by fasting for 6 months. Verses like this do not negate the necessity of regular vows, such as observing the Ekadasi fast. We see the same role by eating prasadam as fasting for 6 months. Okay, forget it. It does not negate. It's just singularing. I think the point was made. This is how Shakti is interpreted. An activity is singled out for its unique capacity to yield the desired result. Although fasts such as Ekadasi are regular duties, it is understood that they bestow tremendous results that are concomitant in nature. And Shiva Goswami, he goes further. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but sometimes when it mentions things about a codicy, it meant we should give up fasting on mixed codicies. I don't know how these tithis work, but those who are born in India, they kind of know how this works, but you're fasting on the Dwadasi. It's something, if the Ekadasi appears in the dark half of the lunar month, it's something like that. So there's a mixed Ekadasi, so you're supposed to give it up and fast on Dwadasi. There's all technicalities. So he goes on, because evidently people were giving this up. So Jiva Goswami really gives a commentary. In a dialogue between Bhishma and Yudhisthira from the first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, it is said, Bhishma enunciated the principles of Dharma related to the Supreme Lord. In commenting on the verse, Sridhar Swami states, the word Bhagavat Dharma refers to duties that are pleasing to the Lord, such as observing the Dwadasi fast. And in the third canto, it is said, the Dura observed vows to please Lord Hari. The third canto, it says, Tre Bhatani Haditoshanani. It says that these brothers, the Dura, when he left, he performed brothers, and in the commentary, it says Ekadasi, to please the Supreme Lord. And from the conduct of Ambarish, the crestjewel of devotees, he took a vow of accepting only remnants of food off the earth. It is self-evident that Ekadasi is a regular vow to be observed by all Vaishnavas. So just because it was singled out for special glorification, satsanga, and people started to neglect Ekadasi, and then Jiva goes through the Shastra. And when I listened to this from Satyanarayan, he made one point that was nice also. There's only one thing that Lord Chaitanya asked Mother Yasoda to do. Follow Ekadasi. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, Madhavatiti Bhakti Janani. Madhavatiti, the days of Lord Hari, like Ekadasi, Bhakti, they give birth to devotion. So these are extremely important activities for a Vaishnava to follow. One way in which you can maintain your spiritual your spiritual taste or yeah, inspiration is to observe a codicil properly, which means to really substantially increase the chanting and hearing about Krishna. I remember in Vrindavan that I'm doing it here. I try to, a little more difficult because I'm traveling and what the speaking people are going on trains, cars, working in different places naturally. But I can attest to that fact that a sincere observance of the codicil, where it means that you give that day to Krishna in chanting and hearing, it will revive Bhakti Janami. Bhakti will be born from your heart. Bhakti is our taste for serving Krishna. And that sometimes we're frustrated that we're taught, well, this is one of the ways. Okay, I'm going to stop today for questions. I didn't really even realize that I'm... But now a wonderful, wonderful association, a wonderful, wonderful section of verses are going to come up in this... In the section of, again, this 12th chapter, Jiva Goswami is just going to analyze these verses. It's the most wonderful description of satsanga. And he what's going to come up, which is really wonderful, is how he's going to give example how in every yuga, living entities entangled in the mode of ignorance gain the association of devotees. And a verse is quoted where it's going to describe every kind of type of person, class of person, species of life, and we'll go over all the stories, how in every instance, by satsanga, it's going to, if you state a philosophical point and then you give the practical example. And he's going to give a practical example how by satsanga, by service to the devotees, there's an example in every species of life, every classification of person that was elevated to the highest platform of devotional service by association of the road. Are there any questions?
Hi, Pishmanaj.
Yeah, I know.
Hi, Bo. Yes, actually, I just wanted to see if I can clarify my understanding that even though service can be made directly to Krishna, it's still better. If, let's say, take an example of maybe, building a temple.
Yeah.
It's still, and that's, that's one of those things that I guess in the end of the 11th chapter, the 11th canto there.
Yeah.
Is one of those things that may or may not be done directly for Krishna. But a service that is done...
No. What it meant is that you can make gardens for social welfare activities, which is pious. You can dig wells, which are pious. But you can dig wells for like devotees. Like you can make kuns in Vrindavan. You can make beautiful gardens as a civic way, and you can make gardens for the deities. That's what that meant.
Yes. Yeah, that's how I understood it.
Okay.
And even when you do service that's directly for Krishna,
yeah,
it's still better to do that same service. Let's say you're building a temple. It's still to do it in the mood that, let's say you're assisting one of Krishna's devotees, in the mood of, that sadhu sangha. Rather than doing it directly for Krishna, let's say I'm trying to help Srila Prabhupada, or I'm trying to help my guru build a temple, not that I'm trying to build a temple for Krishna directly.
Right. You see, when they give these type of verses that one thing is better than another, you know, we should try to analyze what makes it better. You know, it's just like when you say Raghunuga is better than Vaidhi Bhakti. Why? What makes it better? Well, if you do things out of attachment, you're more absorbed. And absorption is the principle that purifies the consciousness. The holy name is better than Smaran. Why is the holy name better than Smaran? Because the holy name, the chanting absorbs all the senses, and the sound vibration comes into the consciousness. It's more absorbing. But obviously speaking, that if there's verses that say that if someone's on the platform of Smaran and he can remember Krishna, that's obviously just as good as chanting about Krishna. So what makes it is the service of the devotees. One of the aspects of it, of course, well, there's many things about it, but one thing is the idea of the selflessness of it. You know, that's why when we talk about in our lives, there's two types of kambog. I'm going to explain it, but I'm using the term sambandha. There's two types when you serve kama in a conjugal relationship with Krishna. There's two ways in which it can be done. One is called sambhog ichamayi, and one is called tatpad bhava ichamayi. Sambhog means you directly have union with Krishna. That's like, you know, and in other, tatpad bhava ichamayi, it's like the manjaris, where their pleasure is not being directly with Krishna in conjugal relationship, but assisting Radharani. So it has a sense of selflessness. And ultimately what pleases Krishna is the devotion. So that sense of service, dasa dasa anu dasa, servant of Krishna. But you're right, Gail, like just like when you do deity worship, and that was mentioned before, you can do it two ways. You can directly worship the deity, but in the mood of service to my guru. Like your guru, the guru can say, please worship the deity. So you can be worshiping directly, but the mood of service to the guru, or you can be in the mood that you're assisting the guru who's directly worshiping Krishna. But yes, but the whole mood is to serve, is service of the devotee. But I mean, you can go on and on about this, but another fact is that Krishna loves the devotees. And there's many, many things that Krishna can do that he wants. But one thing that's a little bit difficult for Krishna to do is to serve the devotee. Because the devotee doesn't want to accept service from Krishna. Because Krishna is the superior. So the devotee doesn't want to serve him. So it's very hard for Krishna to serve his devotee. So by serving the devotee of Krishna, you're doing you're fulfilling a very intimate desire of Krishna. A very, very intimate desire of Krishna. So anyway, your point was right, Gail. Okay, thank you, Gail. Any other questions?
Maharaj?
Yeah.
Thank you for a great class. I appreciate it.
I'm amazed, Mahamuni, that you're on the class today.
My mother's with me right now.
Okay, good. But those of you on the class, Mahamuni is the proud father of his second child, Lila Madhurya. I thought with two children and studying for his degree, he would be overwhelmed. His mother came to save the day. Okay.
Even if she wasn't here, these classes are... they helped me survive, so...
Okay, good.
So, Harsh, you were making a point about how scriptural teachings have to understood in certain contexts, and that it seems like they have different applications in different contexts.
Yeah.
Okay, here's my question, Marge.
Yeah.
Sometimes it seems like we talk about karma as a kind of fixed law that's in the scriptures. And
right.
Even if you, just like you break the laws of the state, ignorance is not an excuse. Because you should be, if you're a human being, you should ask enough questions to actually get a sense of what God's law is. So ignorance is not an excuse. On the other hand, it seems like, if I remember there's a quotation where Prabhupada said to Mother Ermila, to her father, or something like, if her father followed the Torah strictly, he'd go to the heavenly planets or something like that.
Yeah.
A kind of famous quote. So, do I understand that karma itself is applied in a somewhat relativistic way according to maybe the scriptural tradition that you are a member of? And even then, it may have relative application according to your situation?
I'm not sure about that, but what I would say is that there is universal laws that I guess different religious traditions profess and have understanding of to different degrees. And there's certainly I forgot where I was reading this recently. I was reading this in Bhakti Sandarbha about, I forgot where I was reading. I was actually listening to a tape where even if you do something wrong, your awareness of the activity. In other words, if you do something wrong that you know it's wrong, there's a greater reaction than if you do something if you do something more innocently. Now let's see that instance of if you follow the Torah, etc. Even that has to be taken in context. I mean, I would have to, make a judgment whether Prabhupada was like actually applying the law of karma, to another tradition that he understood, or Prabhupada was making the point, some other point that people are hypocritical and not following their own religion, and there'd be so much benefit if they did, So I'm not really sure, I'm not even sure. You have something in mind. Can you make me explain a little bit more clearly?
Well, I guess, Marge, there's two kind of broad questions in my mind.
Yes.
One is the question of religious diversity, and the other is the question of how, when you become a bhakta, karma doesn't work the same way for you anymore.
Let me answer that.
And so the second case, I think it seems clear to me. I've heard you explain in the past that if you are trying to turn towards Krishna, then you're doing the job of karma. So karma doesn't have to, there are some lessons karma would have taught you that you don't need anymore because you're actively turning to Krishna. I've heard you explain that in terms of when you become
Krishna. But I've also explained that because karma is a law, right, that's supposed to teach you the lesson of selflessness. Because it's a reaction to fruit of the selfish activity, right?
Mm-hmm.
And because there are different aspects of selfishness in our consciousness which Krishna witnessed in our previous life and therefore set up karma to give us reactions to that, that if you become a devotee, right, it's likely that Krishna will just let his law run to purify you because it's still going to bring you closer to Krishna. Whether you're a non-devotee or a devotee, your karma is meant to give you an experience to bring you closer to Krishna by making you more pure and selfless. So I think from both standpoints are there. But yeah, technically Krishna can reduce it. But I think, as we see, there's also something called Prarabdha Karma. There's actually, I was with a Advaita over the weekend, and he's really doing a nice study of the Yoga Sutras. For those of you who don't know, he's Professor Edwin Bryant. So he's a professor when you went to college, Mom, and you lived with him also, right? But he's studying the Yoga Sutras, and he was explaining that there are three types of karma. There's karma which you haven't suffered from yet, right? Let's say that, you know, by your karma, something's going to happen to you in the future. Now, you're destined to get mugged, you know, maybe in 10 lifetimes, you know, you're destined to be under an institution that, you know, is heavy at you. You're destined to, you know, all these things are all set up, you know. You're destined to be cheated in the business dealing, but they haven't manifested. There's a story of that. When you actually surrender to Krishna, then, you know, you actually surrender to Krishna, then you can free yourself from that completely. You know, if you actually, you know, give up food and you surrender to Krishna, there's karma that's being created right now. Of course, you can also finish that. But there's Prarabdha karma, and that means that there's karma that's already in motion. For example, let's say your arm gets cut off, right? So you're a one-armed person, right? And now you meet the devotees and you surrender to Krishna, right? It doesn't mean the arm grows back. That's already in motion with this body. You know? You're going to suffer not having one arm your whole life, whether you become a devotee or not. There's certain karma that's already set in motion, right? And basically, it's your body in this lifetime. And there are certain things that are actually set at birth in this lifetime. In other words, they're within the body. They're within the genes. They're within your, you know, your constitution. There's certain things which are already set and already in motion that most likely. And it says the way you can get rid of Prarabdha Karma is if you become liberated. But what happens is when you're liberated, it means the body is finished. You're liberated, you'll get rid of Prarabdha Karma. So I heard someone lecturing on this, right? It'd be a great movement where you can preach, right? Join Krishna consciousness, you'll be dead. You get liberated, that's it. The body's finished. But what the commentators say is our goal is not liberation. Our goal is prema bhakti. And to get prema bhakti, you need a body to practice. So it's understood that the Prarabdha Karma, that Krishna will allow the Prarabdha Karma to go simply because it's favorable for you to get prema, because it's favorable to have the body. And as we know in the 8th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, karma is defined as, you know, as getting a material body. The material body just runs by karma. So in terms of your the second question, which is bhakti and its relationship to karma, you know, it's basically you're under Krishna, he can do what he wants, he can change it, but he generally lets it go. And the reactions are generally reduced because they're reduced in two ways. They're reduced in one way is because of your devotional attitude. Then you don't experience pain in the same way. I was reading this book, Encounters with Divinity, and Sridhar Maharaj gave a great example. The example he gave was, he said, like, if someone's patriotic, and he really has the goal of fighting for his country, right? And he's a great kshatriya, a great general. Then, even if he gets wounded, because of his attitude, the suffering becomes negligible because the goal is so powerful. So when you become a devotee and your goal is so powerful, like that, then the suffering becomes reduced just by your consciousness. The other way the suffering becomes reduced is our actions, obviously, even in this life, affect our future. And what I do today changes my karma for tomorrow, for sure. Yes, some destiny will come, but, you know, I could have been destined to be very sick, but I read a health book today, right, and I passed it. So I'm still destined to be sick, and I'll have to struggle with that, but I reduced the sickness. Why? Because the decisions I made today determine my fate tomorrow. So in that sense, the bhakti can be reduced. The reactions can be reduced. And your first question was?
Well, my thank you, Mars. That was very clear. My first question was that when we look at the difference between religious traditions, we've all had the experience of Christians who sometimes say that even if you were born in a situation where you didn't hear about Jesus, well, sorry, you go to hell.
Yeah.
I know many Christians don't say that, but some do.
Yeah.
It seems to me as wrong for a devotee to say that if you were born in a way where you weren't aware of the Vedic scriptures, you're still bound by the laws that are in the Vedic scriptures. That seems to me as, if we don't like the Christian thing, I don't see how we can do that and think that it's different. It seems to me that...
But they're not, you know, we don't look at them, let me get this clear, we don't look at them as Vedic laws. We look at them as universal laws. But then there's a factor that, you know, there's also definitely a factor that, give me an example. Someone grows up in a place, right? I'll ask you, and they kill cows, right? They never heard of it, they never read about it, they never read it in the scriptures. Is it sinful or not? Probably the reaction would be much less. It's just like, you know, idea, you know, actually we travel around, we visit relatives and things, and they eat meat, you know, or whatever it is, you know? And we still look at them, you know, if they're nice people, we look at them as nice people, right? But when I'm in India and someone says that they're a meat eater, you know, I have such a harsher view of them, you know, because they should know better, you know? The culture is vegetarian, like that. But I still can't say it is. I think of that. I think, you know, consciousness and doing things wrong, and you don't know things are wrong, you know, the reactions are much, much less. But I can't say that there's no reaction. And you can't say either that the person's not responsible in some way. Let's carry this forward, Mohammed.
Well,
what else?
I know. I think that's a good answer. I don't really know what else to say.
Yeah.
But there is an issue when people are in one religious tradition and they really believe they're coming to God and they're following their conscience. And maybe there's things that aren't covered in a more elaborate religious tradition, like let's say the Buddhist.
Yeah.
And the only way I can imagine resolving it is something like God ultimately judges their hearts according to their sincerity. I don't know how else to think.
I would say that that's definitely a main factor. I was giving a class. I spoke at Ami and Nimai's. It was really we had a really nice program there. You know, I don't know if you've been to East 95th Street.
No.
It's a block from Kasuba's house. So I stayed with Kasuba in the evening and did a prayer. And it was nice, you know. We had about 25, 30 people. And just a lot of, you know, a lot of nice people came. So I was speaking on, you know, taking shelter. And I was giving the example, you know, about faith, how much faith people have, right? And I gave this example often, and it's my mother's cousin. My mother's cousin was, a chaplain in the military. You know, I think he had a degree from Harvard Seminary. He had a PhD, you know, and, you know, he was kind of a very, like, revolutionary, progressive person, and But, you know, at that particular time, you know, patriotism looked like much more noble than it does today somehow, you know, fighting the Nazis and going to war. You know, he dedicated his life. You can see he just wanted to help others and, like, volunteered. He didn't have to go. He wanted to go on the front, and he wound up on this ship that was transporting goods from Greenland to, you know, in the cold, and it was very dangerous. And they got the ship got hit by a German submarine, and you know, everyone, you know, they saved so many people. They gave up their own life vests. They didn't leave the ship until they tried to get everyone else out, you know? And obviously it was chaos. So, you know, probably half the people died, half the people were saved or something like that. But when the ship went down, the people that they saved were in these lifeboats, and they saw them, like, arm in arm holding together, because there was a rabbi, you know, two Protestants, and a Catholic priest. Arm in arm, like linked in arm, singing the Psalms of David. So I was giving the example, you know. Look how much faith, Charanagata, they had in God. You know, how much did they have, was their show for their relationship with God, and how much confidence they had. You know, and I made a joke. If I was the sannyas Hare Krishna chaplain on board, right, I would have said, okay, get the boat ready for the Maharajas. You know? Okay, you know? Yeah. I mean, would I have been there with them linking arms, you know? And then when I said that, right, they probably were all meat eaters. You know? They were probably all meat eaters, so I mean, so there is some, I don't think a rational person can deny that there is some context and relevance according to your situation and knowledge. But I think also a person can't deny that there also are God's laws. And, you know, somehow or other, whether they went in their next life, they're going to have to give up that habit, you know? So maybe some situation would be arranged, you know? And, you know, who knows what happens to people, you know? Who knows what we were in our last life? Just think of all the suffering we're going through and have to go through in our own lives. Probably everyone on this phone, you know? And we were all, you know, who knows what religion we were in our past lives? Who knows what we did in our past lives to cause what's happening to us now? You know, so it's hard to say who's ahead and who also, right? But, you know, we see this person's born, they're eating meat, but, you know, in a previous life, they may have been great devotees and then somehow did some sin and then got born, and then when they join, right, they immediately surrender and get deep into Krishna consciousness and become saints, right? So let's say, you know, I may be a vegetarian now, right? And now there may be someone who's even a meat eater. But he may have more sukriti. Because he may meet the devotees tomorrow and then fully surrender in a way that I can't due to his past sukriti. Because most of us were meat eaters and then we joined and something was awakened from our past. So I think the law of karma is kind of very intricate, but, I definitely think a broad-minded person has to think it very deeply, and I think that there is some context, for sure. But I don't think it's an absolute context. I think there are God's laws.
Okay, so then if I understand you, it's not like it's something where the laws are really meant as kind of guideposts to aim for. They're all laws, but it's probably the case, or at least it's reasonable, that the laws are applied on a contextual basis.
There is laws or shastra that there is, when we say shastra, we're talking about just God's laws. And some people have more knowledge of what they are, and some people have more or less according to traditions, but it's all God's law. There are laws of God that reduce the reaction of activities if one is ignorant of it. And then there's even something called, emergency dharma. Prabhupada was even talking about if you have to go preach in some country, he even said this. You don't even have to eat meat, in an emergency. There's emergency dharma. No one ever did it. No one would have to do it. You don't have to do it. But, let's say you could save thousands of people and you had to go into a culture and that's all you can eat. You may have to do it. So there's all kinds of considerations. But to figure it out, it'd be pretty tough. But thank you, Mamuni.
Well, thank you for taking that.
Thank you for exercising my brain. Anyway, anybody like to say Hare Krishna before we hang up here? Well, everybody already went. Okay.
Hi, Krishna Maharaj.
Who's that?
This is Kishore Radha.
Thank you, Kishore Radha. And Hare Krishna.
Hi, Bob.
Thank you so much. Okay. I got the package today. Thank you very much.
Oh, good. I'm glad
okay.
to hear that.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, you're welcome.
Okay. Manchakalpa Purubhyascha Krita Sindhu Paribhya Abhidhyam Pavanevyo Vaishnavevyo.